The judge in Egypt, who adjourned the trial of Hosni Mubarak today until August 15th, ordered him held at a military hospital in Cairo until that date, dispersing the crowds that had gathered in the court and in front of TVs across the country to watch their former president lying in a gurney in a barred cage to hear the charges against him. Mubarak claims he has cancer and is too sick to face charges of ordering the killing of nearly 900 protesters during the February uprising that forced him from power. He entered a not guilty plea today. This trial is happening as some of the surviving protesters ask, instead of being his victims, should we have used violence? After all, the military that assumed power after Mubarak left is still cracking down. Journalist Thanasi Kambanis, just back from Cairo, is writing about this provocative conversation. We're going to speak with him in a moment. But first, let's check in with the Egyptian blogger known as Sand Monkey, Mahmoud Salem. We spoke with him during the uprising and reached him again in Cairo today. Hello?
Hello. Hi, Robin. What's up?
What's up with you? How are you?
I'm in a taxi without air conditioning. It's hot and people are fasting. It's Ramadan and traffic sucks. Other than that, I'm having a fantastic day.
Well, Mahmoud, we have some serious questions for you on this day. First of all, what were your thoughts in seeing Hosni Mubarak in a cage, on a gurney, beginning a trial?
Well, the gurney was expected because he would try to garner any kind of sympathy. However, part of me, of course, is very happy to see him behind bars and seeing this trial actually happening. And part of me thinks that this trial will be probably the biggest distraction to everything and anything in Egyptian society for the next few months. I'm happy but concerned.
Well, and you say it's distraction from the other things that are going on. Let's talk about that. The fact that he's being charged in the deaths of 900 people during the uprising underscores the fact that this was not a bloodless uprising in Egypt. People died, but still it's being called a nonviolent uprising. And we're hearing that some activists are now questioning whether that was the wise thing to do. They're wondering if, in fact, they helped foment a coup, not a revolution. And there are some who are now quoted as saying, you know, maybe we need to take to more violent means in order to get the authoritarian military regime out in Egypt. Have you been hearing that conversation?
Oh, yeah. Personally speaking, I do not support, you know, any kind of violent measures. I think there are other ways to play, whether or not the idea of the nonviolent revolution has actually helped cover up for a coup. Well, yeah, technically, there was a coup, definitely, because the revolution is not in power and the revolution is not getting its demands unless it exerts an enormous amount of pressure.
Well, I guess
Does this answer your question?
Well, yeah, well, I guess it just prompts a further one, which is, what do you think happens now? You've just said you don't agree that now there should be violence when there was not before on the part of protesters. You don't agree with that thinking, but do you think that these people will hold sway, that this idea that to really fully throw off an authoritarian regime, which they now feel the military is in that role where Mubarak was before, that really, really to get the rights that you are looking for, violence may be needed?
Well, I'll put it to you this way. I'm not going to call for it, you know, and if it happens, it happens. If people believe that peaceful means, you know, have ended and they can't use peaceful means to get their demands anymore, they will definitely go for violence. I don't want to see assassinations. I don't want the entire revolution to be branded as a terrorist uprising.
So you're saying one of your worries about, you know, if there is violence, is that it'd be too easy to have you and others who are demanding rights be labeled as terrorists?
Immediately. And they're heading in that direction. All people who are talking about how this is, that we should do more violence and stuff like that, like, you know, those are people who don't understand that this is evidence against them, you know, and the average Egyptian who supports the revolution got so sold on the idea of it being a nonviolent revolution that they're not going to support violence right now, especially not against the army.
Well, Mahmoud, I should know this, but what does one say? Do I wish you a peaceful Ramadan? How do I express that?
Okay. Well, you know, just say, wish me a happy Ramadan. And don't say Ramadan Mubarak, though, because that's usually like the greeting.
Oh, is that the old greeting?
Because Mubarak means like, yeah.
I won't. I wish you a happy Ramadan.
Thank you.
Well, let's turn now to journalist Thanasis Kambanis. Just back from Egypt, he wrote a provocative column in the Boston Globe recently, headlined A Call to Arms, looking at that question, you know, whether in order for the revolution in Egypt to be successful, it must turn from velvet to violent. More Iran or France than Poland or Ukraine. There's a link to his article at herenow.org. He joins us on the line. And Thanasis, first of all, did what Mahmoud, sand monkey, just said square with what you're hearing from activists in Egypt? He doesn't want violence. He thinks that's a gift to the ruling military, who can then call protesters terrorists. But he's hearing people talk about it.
Yeah, I mean, I think he's hearing the same voices that I heard and reported about in my piece. The strategic thinkers among the activists and protesters, like Mahmoud, have been very, very smart, very strategic, and they've clearly recognized that the military is looking for some way to paint them as extremists, as destabilizing, as bad for Egypt. So, of course, naturally, any calls for violence would play in to that effort to demonize the revolutionaries. So, again, Mahmoud and a lot of other articulate revolutionary leaders like him have said to their peers, hey, guys, violence is a terrible idea. There's no way we can overthrow the military or really defeat the 1.5 million police in Egypt. Our best tool is nonviolence. Now, that said, there are legions of young activists who aren't political activists. They're not in any party or organization. They filled the streets in January and February, and they were really the mass that made this a successful uprising. And they're not, I don't think I'm demeaning them by saying they're not strategic thinkers. They're frustrated Egyptians, and they see the achievements of January and February as quite ephemeral. They see that they toppled Mubarak, and he was replaced by a bunch of generals, and they want a lot more. They want a liberal democracy, and they don't see any movement towards that, and they're angry.
Thanasi, do they think they enabled a coup instead of having a revolution?
I mean, that's one way of putting it. The truth is that Egypt has always been a military dictatorship throughout its modern history. So you could call it a coup. I would call it simply a change of chief executive in an existing military dictatorship. But I mean, that's a semantical debate.
And Thanasi, I want to ask you about reaction in the U.S. We mentioned it before the break that there was a respected study from academics that showed that nonviolent revolutions, were twice as successful as violent revolutions in their goals. But you say there might be a backlash now?
Well, right. This is a sort of growing consensus that I think stemmed out of both the desire to see peaceful transitions to democracy and also out of the experience of the fall of the Soviet Union. So we got this new paradigm for revolutionary shifts without bloody revolutions.
Sure, you had Poland, you had Czechoslovakia. I mean, there was bloodshed, but it was nonviolent resistance. Ukraine.
Dozens or hundreds at most people killed in quick popular protests that lead to the fall of a long-time tyrannical regime. So that view has been codified in the scholarship, most recently with this study that chronicled hundreds of nonviolent and violent uprisings from the last century and concluded that nonviolence works much better than violence, and for two main reasons. One, because it garners more international support, and secondly, because it's harder for despots to crush likable nonviolent demonstrators. Now, this study, of course, and this understanding has one big gaping hole, which scholars who are a lot smarter than me have pointed out, and that is the sort of dog that doesn't bark fallacy. So what about all the cases where there isn't an uprising, like in China? Or what about the exceptions to the rule where nonviolent protests are brutally crushed into submission, like in Iran? Are those actually much more important than a statistical trend that highlights effective but maybe marginal or small revolutions or uprisings in places where the regime isn't that brittle or cruel in the first place?
And you also have the violent revolutions that worked. You point to France. And so here's the debate. And We know that many of the protesters in Egypt, for instance, in Serbians, turned to former Harvard professor Gene Sharp. We've profiled him. He's here in the Boston area. He's lionized by insurgents around the world who follow his online guidelines for nonviolent resistance. He's one of those who takes apart every violent resistance. He can go back to even the American Revolution and point to how it might have happened with nonviolence. But you're now speaking to academics who say, I'm not so sure.
Well, and let's be clear, no one's endorsing the idea of, you know, the French Revolution's Jacobin terror or the Bolsheviks in Russia as a great template for how to build a liberal state after dictatorship. So no one's saying that. What they are saying is that potentially a state that rules by force or that rules by the gun and refuses to give up power might only be overthrown by that same gun, by that same law of force or law of the jungle. Now these same historians will point out that this has pernicious consequences. A revolution or a popular uprising that succeeds by violence or terror is likely to then rule by terror. We saw that in the French Revolution, in which it took nearly a century for France to actually then have a liberal state. And we saw this in Russia, where scholars like Mark Kramer at Harvard pointed out to me that the initial revolution there was actually quite peaceful, and then there was a coup within the revolution by the violent Bolsheviks, who then instituted a brutal dictatorship that could be held responsible for a lot of horrible things in Russia in the century that followed. So it's a double-edged sword, really. If violence might be the only thing that can unseat a tyrant like, say, Gaddafi in Libya or Bashar Assad in Syria. At the same time, you then run the risk of replacing one dictator with another.
Or, as we said in Egypt, replacing a Mubarak with his military. Let's just go back to Egypt for a second. Where do you think this is going? You speak to people like Ayman Abu Zaid, a 25-year-old cardiologist. He slept in front of Egyptian army tanks to stop them from advancing in Tahrir Square in the beginning. But he's become more radicalized. He's now saying things to you like, you know, the police officer who killed your son, you go and kill him. You know, where do you think someone like him and, you know, I guess I'm asking, where do you think this will go in Egypt?
Well, I heard at least a dozen people tell me that they were contemplating with a lot of relish the idea of vigilante hits against former regime henchmen. And so former torturers, policemen who murdered people, and so on, finding them and killing them in their homes. And many of the strategic activists I talked to said, well, we don't support that kind of action, but if it were to happen, it might be a useful form of public pressure. Now, of course, this is the dangerous experiment of embarking on violence. I think there's a lot of energy in the Egyptian public that could end up being channeled into activities like this. If more than half a year after the revolution, there has been not a single police officer convicted of murder or torture, police officers haven't been purged or fired. So in other words, the entire apparatus of Mubarak's regime that really ritually humiliated and abused the Egyptian public for decades, if it's not being held accountable and put to justice, I think certainly some people will take justice into their own hands and attempt some kind of vigilante attacks. And then the question is, will the ruling junta use that to institute a really hardcore new return to dictatorship, or will it lead to some kind of further compromise on their part?
Thanasi Kambanis, again, his article, Velvet Versus Violent Revolutions, is at herenow.org. His latest book, A Privilege to Die, Inside Hezbollah's Legions and Their Endless War Against Israel. We highly recommend it. It's now out in paperback. Thanasi, we'll just watch what's unfolding with your words in mind. Thanks so much.
Always a pleasure, Robin.
Same here.